start using cutting-edge Warp Speed 5G technology with your cell phone. Let me tell you about my friends at mobilemobile.io. They have an ultra-fast 4G LTE and 5G network that covers 99% of Americans. So they've got you covered everywhere. Think about it for a moment. You have the opportunity to take a test drive for 10 days with unlimited talk, text, and premium data. What is premium data? Premium data is an allotment of a cellular data that you receive from a higher priority on the network. You won't get throttled like you will with some of those, well,
non-brand
service providers. To find out more information, all you have to do is go to mobilemobile.io. That's mobilemobile.io to start your 10-day free trial.
This episode is powered by Safety FM. You are listening to a renowned safety expert, Dr. Jay Allen. Dr. Jay Allen on Safety FM. This episode of the broadcast and the podcast is brought to you by Safety Focus Moment. They're consultants that want to help you get the safety culture you've been looking for. For more information, go to safetyfocusmoment.com.
Hello and welcome to Safety FM. This is Jay Allen. As I told you, as we were starting the new year, there'd be some changes coming our general direction here at Safety FM. So if you haven't had an opportunity, take a listen to our newest show, Safety Talks with Steve Sisson. It's available on all podcatchers, and it's also available at safetyfm.live. So this week, we're going to have a pretty interesting interview. Let me tell you exactly how it all started. Received an email from Dr. Todd Conklin saying, "Hey, I have a gentleman that I think would be great to be on your show and for you to interview him." So he gave me the contact information, and all of a sudden, I contacted this gentleman, and I have to tell you, he was quite a gem of an interview. And the gentleman that I'm speaking about is Dr. Popoliti. Let me kind of give you a little bit of his background. Ivan applies his experience and research to operation in complex systems in high-risk environments such as wildland firefighting, aviation, military, and medicine. As a U.S. Forest Service Director, Ivan developed and implemented the Learning Review, which is a process designed to improve how large and small organizations respond to accidents and incidents. The Learning Review is centered on understanding and mapping systemic conditions that influence human actions and decisions. Ivan's ability to integrate academic research with a real-world application comes from his varied life experiences, which have included work as a mine geologist and a U.S. Coast Guard pilot for rescue and law enforcement missions. Ivan served in the U.S. Air Guard and Air Force Reserves. He also served on active military operations for combat and humanitarian supports in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Central Africa. Ivan has earned his master's degree in human factors and system safety at Lund University, Sweden, under Professor Sidney Decker. He's also completed his PhD in organizational culture at Tilburg University in the Netherlands. He has also completed the USC Aviation Safety Program and the United States Air Force Accident Investigation and Board President courses. So as you can see, Dr. Ivan is quite a subject matter expert. Sit back and relax and enjoy our conversation with Dr. Ivan here on Safety FM.
You are listening to a renowned safety expert, Dr. Jay Allen, on Safety FM. Changing safety cultures, one broadcast and one podcast at a time. Join the fun on social media and find us on Facebook at Safety FM.
So I guess really we can just start off with, how did you get involved in safety, and did it happen by accident, or is this something that you were interested in doing starting off?
So I love the language of that question. Did my involvement in safety come by accident? And the answer to that is yes. And it's because it came from actually many accidents. So I flew active duty Coast Guard for 10 years. And in that period of time, I was party to two fatal accidents, one of which involved a friend of mine. So in 10 years, two fatal accidents and the loss of one friend. I joined the Forest Service, and within the first year, I'd lost three friends in fatal aviation accidents. By the time I'd been in the business for 5 years, we'd lost in the neighborhood of 15 people that were close friends, people I had dinner with one night and they were dead the next. And I felt at that point that I had to do something different. I had to get out of the cockpit a little bit more and get more engaged in how to create safety and figure out how safety was actually created, because not everybody was crashing and we were all doing dangerous work. Flying low level is pretty much dangerous work, especially low level over fires. And we're dropping retardant 125 feet above the trees, sometimes a little bit lower than that. So the work that we're doing, I would guess that most people would agree, is pretty dangerous, pretty high risk, and our fatality rates were commensurate with that. But it wasn't until I got involved with safety at an aviation basis, so I was actually promoted to become a regional aviation safety manager. It wasn't until then that I started really doing accident investigations for the Forest Service. And I'd been educated by the military, had gone to Navy accident investigation school, several other courses, and completed a complete curriculum in that. I completed the USC aviation safety program. And I'd been involved in a couple of accidents on the military side because I was also an Air Force reservist, and I was involved with the Air Force Safety Center as well as flying for the Air Force Reserves. So my involvement in safety kind of grew organically. I didn't start out as a safety person. I started out as an operator. But because I was exposed to so many fatalities, I felt like something had to be done. So that's kind of how I came into it.
Now, I know that you referenced right there that these were people that you knew and they were friends of yours. What are we talking like a length of time in between, you know, that all these occurrences happened?
In aviation, we were averaging 2.5x accidents, fatal accidents a year. That's a lot when you think about it. And that was for the first 10 years that I was in the Forest Service. So some of these things were fatigue issues with aircraft. For example, two of the accidents that occurred in the first 10 years of the Forest Service were wing separations, which happened to a C-130 and also a PB-4Y. And as luck would have it, I had dinner with a PB-4Y crew the night before they died, and had actually flown on a fire with them the day before. And I knew the folks in the C-130 quite well, although I was on the other side of the country when they crashed. So the other accidents, though, for the most part, were what the FAA would term, and the NTSB would term, CFIT accidents, which is controlled flight into terrain. Kind of argue with that terminology a little bit, because if you really were in control, like really fully in control, would you fly into terrain? And I think the answer to that is probably no. So I started thinking about that, and that started me down a path of questioning the way we were approaching accidents. And the upshot of that was that I stepped into the safety role, and I was assigned to be a chief investigator for an accident, a fatality accident that occurred on the Klamath National Forest that involved ground units as well as aviation units. And when I made that, crossed that bridge and realized that the ground folks were facing even higher risk than the aviation folks, for example, in a period of time since 1994, the Forest Service and wildland firefighting communities have experienced over 400 wildland firefighter fatalities. That's a lot of people. And I started looking at what was going on, what was happening. And I started asking questions quite a bit differently at that point. And I actually entreated a dear friend of mine, a guy by the name of Najmuddin Meshkadi. He's a professor at University of California, Los Angeles. Excuse me, I got that wrong. He's a professor from USC. And he's been there for over 30 years. And he was introduced to me through the aviation safety program at USC. And he taught human factors there. So I brought him on as a way for me to start to learn differently and look differently at accidents, because the process that we had in the Forest Service was abysmal. And Naj helped quite a bit. And then from there, I started a master's degree program at Embry-Riddle University in human factors and it was all right. It wasn't great. It wasn't a great program. But I came across a book in Naja's office, and the book was Field Guide to Understanding Human Error by Sidney Decker. And I grabbed the book in Los Angeles in Naja's office. He gave it to me. By the time I'd reached my home in Denver, Colorado, I'd read the entire book and needed to talk to this guy. So I contacted Sidney, and Sidney said, well, why don't you come join my master's degree program in Lund, Sweden? And so I bailed out of the Embry-Riddle program and immediately joined the Lund program and finished my master's degree with Sidney. And I've got to say, it was probably the most mind-opening experience that I've ever had. And it certainly asked of every class member to look at human actions in a very different way. Instead of looking at the human actions in a way to judge them as right or wrong or good or bad, the program really entreated us to look at accidents and incidents and human actions in terms of the context. Why did it make sense for people to do what they did? And that became a very important and underlying theme for what we later on called the Learning Review in the Forest Service.
Well, Ivan, I have to ask you, so once you actually get a hold of Decker's book and you read it and you say that, you know, you read it from California to Denver and all of a sudden we need to contact Sidney Decker. What was it that, I guess, got you excited by reading the book that you said, I need to get more information?
Well, see, this almost begs a picture of the book. So the post-it notes that are on the margin of this book, on every page of this book, would point to something on nearly every page that said, hey, wait a minute, this is different. Hey, wait a minute, this is important. And so the first was that, I'd been very classically trained in accident investigation. And in that classical training, there's nothing wrong with it. I don't want to say that either this or this. That's not the case. In fact, I would really say it's this and. What I began to realize, though, was that we were so invested in technical ways of looking at accidents and incidents that we were applying the same philosophic approach to a human accident as we did to mechanical accidents. And so the language followed. We had language like, they failed to do this, or there was a failure in this. Well, that language is fundamentally mechanical. Mechanical components fail. People fail too. I mean, don't get me wrong, but there's usually a lot more involved in it than a single root cause that you can pin down. And so Sidney started to challenge those ideas on every page. The ideas that we could have a socio-technical model that was fundamentally rooted in the technical. He challenged that on every page of the book. And he asked us, he said, you know, how can we look at this from the perspective of those involved? How can we start to understand why it made sense? And that question is really a very different question than it is posed by, did the people fail? Were they reckless? Did they not follow rules, regulations, and procedures? It got to the, why did it make sense for them not to follow rules, regulations, policies, and procedures? That became a much more substantive question. And if we think back on James Reason, who I think really put this canoe in the water many years before, when he said, you can't change the human condition. In other words, people are going to make mistakes, right? So you can't change the human condition, but you can change the conditions under which humans work. Well, to me, that meant that our focus should shift from the decisions and actions of people to understanding what the conditions were, because the conditions influence what people do in the workplace. And if we really want to change what people are doing, our focus has to be generated on that specific target of understanding those conditions and then managing the conditions rather than trying to manage the people.
And I guess that really becomes the aha moment for most organizations once they get that information, but it's almost very difficult to have some people buy into that. But let me kind of jump back a little bit and we'll come back to this particular piece. So once you actually get Sidney on the phone and you start talking, how long does it take him to, I won't say convince, but encourage you to join his program abroad?
Super question. So Sidney tells me, hey, Ivan, I'm going to be in Denver next week. I happen to be going to Fort Collins and visiting a friend of mine up there at the university. How would you like to meet me in Fort Collins and drive me to the Denver airport? And I go, sure, not a problem. So we meet in Fort Collins and we start driving and we start dialogue. He's got his son Jonathan with him, and I've got my wife with me, and the four of us are really talking. Jonathan's quite young at the time, but he's still engaged. And we end up going by the Air Force Museum at the old Air Force base there in Denver. And we start poking around old airplanes. And Sydney's excited, and I'm excited. I'm like, well, this guy's not just a social scientist. He's really interested in airplanes, too. And it was by the time that afternoon ended that he said, come join me at the program in London. And I'm going to go one further than that. So he asked me to stick around and start a PhD program with him, which I later had to transfer to Tilburg University because Sydney left Lund. But while I was there and working on the PhD program, I brought my wife to some of the meetings in Sweden. And my wife started to engage with Sydney. And Sydney turns to her and says, well, Chris, you're smarter than I've been. You should by all means join the master's program. And she goes, well, Sydney, I couldn't afford it. And he says, you don't understand. It's on me. You'll be a Sydney special. So my wife actually went through the program at Lund as well as a Sydney special. And so we kind of keep this in the family. We generate a lot of work together. A lot of the things that we do together. There's a paper on the learning review that we actually drafted together. And Chris's specialty is language. And the reason I bring this up is because Sydney really made us think in that master's degree program. His constant underlying question was, is that so? And Chris really took the is that so in the language direction, and she took it very forcefully into the language direction so that she began to start to ask the question, is that so in language? And she found some really fantastic research done by Lyra Boroditsky about language. She found some other really great pieces about language and showed that the language that we were using in accident investigation was actually inhibiting learning. And so it was through this coupling, this dialogue between Chris and I, between the entire Decker crew, between Sydney and I, between Todd Conklin and I. It was in this mix of dialogues and challenging each other and constantly asking, is that so, that different concepts around safety began to emerge. I'll give you an example. As we started looking at safety in the Forest Service, we started realizing, and this is again from Chris's work, that we'd nominalized the word safety. We'd made it a noun. And as we took the activity, the action out of the word safety by making it a noun, we began to hurt ourselves in terms of learning. And Chris points this out. The next thing that emerged out of that was an understanding on the part of all of us that if we weren't moving learning forward, we weren't progressing in safety. So the thing that we based our learning review on were a series of principles that we could all agree to. And one of the principles was that safety, the currency of safety, is information. And if you do things inside your system to disrupt the ability to get information, you're making your system less safe. So that's a big piece of it. But then we also understood that the currency of a safety program, of moving safety forward, the way we actually capitalize on moving safety forward is fundamentally through learning. So our entire perspective on everything said, if we're not learning, if we're not moving learning forward, if we're not putting ourselves in a position where information is not only solicited and encouraged, it's rewarded, then we're not doing what we need to do to make the system safer. And so the question is, well, did anything come of doing this? Well, we instituted the learning review in the Forest Service. We adopted it in 2015. And up until that point, we had been violated by OSHA, generally, usually under the general duty clause, which says essentially that a workplace, an employer is responsible for creating a workplace free from known hazard, which is a little tough when you're fighting wildland fire, right? We pay hazard pay and we go into a forest where there's trees that break and limbs that fall and trees that fall. And, oh, there's fire, by the way. So hazards are kind of part of the job. So that was a little bit ludicrous to us when we'd get that violation. But we listened to it. We understood what OSHA was trying to say. And we kind of fed the fires for OSHA with the old type of investigation, because basically we would say that people failed to follow rules, regulations, policies, and procedures. And, of course, if OSHA sees that, that's kind of an automatic violation. Well, if they didn't follow them, that's because you didn't enforce them. That was the conclusion that they drew. Enter in Sydney's thinking. And our questions became, why did it make sense for them not to follow a rule, regulation, policy, or procedure? procedure? Was the rule not followable? Was it not clear to them? Did it not apply to the circumstance? What was the situation that prevented us or prevented our people from following that rule, regulation, policy, or procedure? So the questions became fundamentally different as a result of this process. And once we got the process up and running, we enjoined OSHA to see what it was that we were doing. And what we were doing was creating network of influences map. We looked at influences, not causes. We wanted to understand the conditions, the situations, if you will, that influenced people to do what they did. And by using the word influence, another gift from our linguistic side, by using the word influence, we didn't have to go and prove causality. It's no longer necessary to say that there was a causal connection between these two things. We can now talk about things in terms of influence. This became super important, especially when we started thinking about fatigue, because nobody could really quantify fatigue, but we knew our firefighters were tired. How could we talk about fatigue if we had to prove that it was causal, when we couldn't really prove the causality because everybody's degree of fatigue is different than everybody else's degree of fatigue? So there's no direct cause-effect relationship. But we can say, and we can all agree, that fatigue was an issue in that it influenced the way people performed on the fire line. Once we started softening that language, we started a different type of dialogue. And then what we realized is that we couldn't just let that dialogue sit in the hands of some investigator who was imbued by the power to do the investigation. Instead, what we had to say was that power is non-existent. The investigator, if you will, in fact, we removed the word investigator altogether. The person who's in charge of this review, this learning review, their job is to bring together the conditions and then verify that those conditions exist in normal work environments. So we literally moved away from the accident as quickly as we possibly could and into normal work. And we started developing these lists of conditions. The first ones were challenging for a lot of our leadership because they look really complicated. They're very big, colorful diagrams with lots and lots of influences on them. And we realized that some of our leadership was overwhelmed by that. And so instead what we did was we started thinking about the conditions in terms of how they could be managed. So the first category would be things that are outside of our control. Are there things that belong strictly to a regulator, for example? And they're outside the organization's ability to control in terms of changing those conditions. In that case, it's an awareness issue, and we needed to be aware that it was there. And if we could, at some point, we might be able to influence the regulator to change the conditions, change whatever it was that they were using as a metric, or whatever it was that they were using as their balancing mechanism to determine if something was done incorrectly or done wrong. The second category were things that are long-term changes. So you would look at these things as things that were like conditions that pointed to the culture of the organization. The third category that we broke the conditions into were conditions that we could change right away and would have an effect on the system. So for example, here we would look at perverse incentives inside the system. What kinds of incentives were inside the system that worked against what the organization asked its people to do? An example of that might be overtime. So overtime is something that's super important to firefighters because it's how they make their money. But are they taking greater chances? Are they working longer hours when they are fatigued so that they can get that overtime? Is overtime, therefore, putting an undue influence inside the system or perverse influence inside the system? So those are things that are fairly short term, and we can go about changing them, pay structure in the organization, work schedules, those kinds of things. And the last category that we had were things that we recognized might have some influence, but the influence was negligible. And if we changed it, it either wouldn't do any good or it could actually create some counterproductive things inside the system, some unforeseen responses, systemic responses. And that's what we then presented to leadership. And then leadership kind of had a menu to look at to start thinking about how they would go about initiating some of these changes. And one of the things that emerged out of that was that leadership actually engaged the entire Forest Service in dialogues. And we were able to feed in some of the topics based on these accidents that we'd had and the conditions that we'd mapped. We were able to feed topics into leadership so that leadership could begin to look at things from a different perspective and start to dialogue with the entire organization about them. The second big or third big benefit that emerged out of the learning review was the families of the fallen firefighters were now recognized. We didn't hold them off. We didn't stiff arm them and keep them in a corner. We literally let them know, as the as the learning review was progressing, that we let them know what we were finding out. We let them know and see what we were learning. And as a result of that, the families felt more involved, and they felt less like we were out to get their family members and more like we were really there to learn something so that the next firefighter in that situation wouldn't have the same problem. And so the family started to really come behind the learning review and stand behind it as opposed to standing against it and in many cases bringing litigation against the organization.
So Ivan, let me ask you a question. So when you start this learning review and this starts going down the path, when are you having, like, year-wise, what year are we talking about you're starting to have these conversations? Well, let's start off with, when did the learning review when was it developed? And then when are these conversations with the family members of the people who were involved in the accidents?
Another great question. So 2006 was the first foray into looking at accidents differently. This was the aviation accident that I mentioned that involved ground personnel. And that's when we first started looking at accidents differently. Every year thereafter, 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010, we were developing the learning review process. And we developed it by trial and error. We tried something to see if it would work, and then we'd keep it if we liked it and it did work, and we'd get rid of it if it didn't work. So it was an iterative process over a period of about 5 or 6 years to about 2012, that we actually formalized the process in 2012, and then it was instituted in 2013. So it took some time to get it to where it was, but during that period of time, we were exploring different ways to do things. We were exploring the idea of focus groups. How do we bring the information that we learned from the accident into the general population to understand if it really did exist in normal work? The way we found to do that best was to have focus groups and simply bring people together who did that type of work and ask them, hey, look at this. This is what we've mapped. These are the influences that we see. Do they exist in your work environment? Are they something that you see on a regular basis? And then we'd also involve the focus group in helping us to figure out what kind of recommendations we might make to leadership, because leadership still wanted recommendations. So we wouldn't sit there as investigators anymore and kind of say, hey, these hands are blessed by God and I'm imbued with all this information and knowledge and I know exactly how to fix the problem. We kind of go, man, we don't know how to fix the problem. And maybe the people that do know how to fix the problem are the ones closest to work, and maybe we should ask them before we write a report that makes us really look silly, because we did a lot of that. And then the third thing that we realized along the way was, you know, maybe we don't think we do as a community either. Maybe we need to bring in outside experts. And for this, we brought in people like Edgar Schein. We brought in Carl Weick. We brought in a dear friend of mine by the name of Ruben McDaniel, who's since passed away. So these are professors who spent their lives researching different aspects of societal interaction, community interaction, culture. And we asked them, hey, what do you see in what we're doing? And they, in every case, provided us with useful insights that allowed us to begin to challenge our concepts. One great example was John Adams, who wrote the book Risk, which was great, and that looked at risk from a very different perspective. We brought John Adams and we asked him, hey, we have a situation here where leadership is saying that they took an unnecessary risk. How do you read this? Help us understand this. And he basically gave us the ammunition that we needed to go back to leadership and say, you know, that perspective is fundamentally flawed, and it's flawed for this reason, that people normalize risks in the workplace. It's not that they're taking unnecessary risks. It's that through the course of a normal operation, as you're exposed to risk, the tendency of every human being is to normalize that risk. So the value of probability, if you will, is diminished in any system where workers are exposed to risk for a prolonged period of time. And when we brought that argument to our leadership, leadership began to see it. And the language, again, inside the organization, inside the agency, the language around risk began to change, and the dialogues began to change around risk, and they began to have a great deal more meaning to our workforce and to our leadership. And it actually bridged a gap. We had a pretty fundamental gap in trust between field and the leadership, and that gap began to close because of the shift in thinking and in questioning and this new language that we were introducing around risk.
So now, do you look back at some of this, and I know that this is going to be terrible wording, but kind of chuckle and go, isn't it amazing that so many years later, we still have the same issue with language and that we still have these same problems inside of organizations? What do you think is causing this?
Oh, it's a great question. It's not a causal thing. It's an influence. And we're influenced by a bunch of different things in our culture. So, for example, it's much easier to look at risk in terms of good or bad, or actions and activities in terms of good or bad actions. And it's super easy to do that if there's been an accident, because then you can just look and say it was a bad action. You should never have done that, which enters into this counterfactual argument Sidney talks so much about in his field guide to understanding human error. But the problem with that is it doesn't get us anywhere, because we're talking about something that never happened instead of talking about what did happen. And so why are we seduced into this? Well, I think that part of the seduction comes from an ease in creating something that looks like it makes sense. And it's an oversimplification. What Carl White would say is we as an organization should be reluctant to simplify. But what we do in accidents is we have a tendency to simplify because we want to tell that simple answer. We want to say that this was the cause and we can fix that cause so that it will never happen again. Well, much of the problem with that is that accident investigations, the entire process, is focused on a single incident as opposed to a group of incidents. And as we look at a single incident, it's easy to go back in and say, if they turned left instead of turning right, then they would have avoided the accident. Does that mean that we should always turn left? And the answer to that is obviously no. The problem with the processes that we had in place where they fixed the accident that happened, but they didn't prepare us for what was happening in the future, because the world was a complex place. Enter Reuben McDaniel. Now, our group, my group, sat at the feet of Reuben McDaniel for several years, learning about complex adaptive systems from Reuben. And Reuben really gave us the idea that what we should be thinking about in a complex system is not trying to fix broken pieces, broken components of the system, not trying to even plug the holes in the Swiss cheese, so to speak, but instead what we should be endeavoring to do is building the capacity of our workforce to make sense of conflicting information, learn in the moment, and innovate solutions. And how do you build a capacity for an organization to do that? Well, the beginning of the call, I think I filled in that I was flying airplanes for a long time. And I look back on my background as an aviator. And what I realized is that sense-making, learning, and improvisation was something that aviators did quite naturally. And so I started thinking, well, if aviators do it quite naturally, why are they doing it quite naturally? So as opposed to looking at the problem from the perspective of why aren't we doing this, I started looking at it from the perspective of why are we and how could we be doing this? And that permeated not only the organization and our approach to training and our approach to education within the organization, but it also changed the way we did our accident investigations. I'm saying those two things are inextricably linked. It also redefined learning for the organization. So as opposed to learning what to do or what not to do, our focus became how can we become better learners in the moment? And a lot of that comes down to things that Amy Edmondson talks about in terms of teaming. I mean, how do we communicate as a group? What Carl White talks about in terms of group sense making, these things start to come into focus for us as we start to network them together. And that's what we began to learn. Now, your question, which I've done a pretty good job, I think, of dodging around, was why don't we change our old way of doing things? Why are we still mired in the old way of doing things? And I think that the best way to do that is to go back to that concept of seductive. What I've suggested in this approach is difficult. It's hard work. It's not easy work to do. And not everybody can do it. But if we think about a technical accident investigation, it's technical. It's not that hard to do. If this, then that, those things are pretty easy. But if our if-then piece is so diluted that if this happens, anything can happen afterwards. An infinite number of varieties of outcomes can result. That's a really big, heady space for people to get into, and it's really quite difficult for folks to do it.
And you see, that's what I start finding interesting, because I always think it's interesting when somebody does, as you deemed, a technical accident investigation. They start off really by doing it from the perspective of they're looking for someone to find fault that actually caused the accident. So when you start taking the approach of what other things caused the failure, now keep in mind that after you have all this stuff in context of, well, this is what happened, this is how the sequence occurred, you're going to have a different context of what happened in real time. So what I look at is, how do you get organizations to do the shift of, oh, you see, it is one of those things that you almost have to chuckle at, because it's an ongoing problem. And we're having this conversation about something that you did years ago. And think about it. It's still an issue that we have today with organizations where they still want to go to the old style of investigation. And let's be realistic. They don't want to change out of whatever system or program that we're using in regards of doing safety, quote unquote, to what we would call the new view safety. So what can we do to influence those people?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think you're really good at what you do. In answering that, I can tell you how we did it in the Forest Service. So we started out with a thing called the Serious Accident Investigation Guide. Chapter 1, second paragraph, stated this: the causes of most accidents or incidents are the result of failures to observe established policies, procedures, and controls. When I got sent on my first investigation, this is the document that I was given. And I read that paragraph and I said, I don't even need to go. I've already got my cause. It's right there. The causes of most accidents or incidents are the result of failures to observe established policies, procedures, and controls. All I have to do is say that. It's simple. Then I can do some little behind-the-scenes stuff. I can do a grandiose timeline if I want to, and I can show this direct relationship between this, this, and this. And I can come up with my summary of findings, and I can come up with my recommendations, and I can give that to leadership. And you know what? After 20 years of that, nothing changed. In fact, our accident rate was getting worse. So having said what I just said, it's really important to see that the impetus on leadership was for some kind of change. So we've got to be in a position where we are willing to challenge the old way of doing things. And that's from a leadership level as well as a field level. The field was screaming because they understood that this was nonsense. The stuff that you're doing is just simply blaming the dead people for their own accident. And it didn't make any sense to them. In fact, they hated it. And the families of the fallen firefighters were suing every single time we put out a report because the findings were fundamentally useless and just telling people that their loved ones were stupid and died because they were stupid or because they just chose not to follow rules, regulations, policies, or procedures. So what we did was we first joined leadership in a dialogue. In fact, we sent them to a program called Dialogos, several of them to a program called Dialogos. It was actually called Learning for the Collective Intelligence, or Leadership for the Collective Intelligence. And that program put several of our top leaders in a position where they began to inquire about the way they were thinking. They got that "is that so" gene infused into their beings. Then they came back into the fold, into the Forest Service, and now they were looking for an answer to that question, "is that so?" Enter in a new way to do investigations. We now present them with a different way of doing it, and they're in a mode of more receptivity because they're looking for something, and we give them something very different. And that's literally what happened when we dropped the first one of these on their desk. I remember it was a hot July day in Washington, D.C. I'm wearing a suit. I'm completely sweating through because it's just brutally hot. And I'm nervous that they're not going to accept this new type of report. And I sit down in the boardroom, and it's very, you know, pomp and ceremony. There's locked doors. There's signs on the doors: do not disturb, secret meeting in progress, blah, 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 blah. All cell phones have to be stashed away. All these kinds of things to maintain top secrecy. All the copies of the document are numbered, and there's a limited distribution of them. And there's voting members on the board. And oh my gosh, it was just lots and lots of pomp and circumstance. And I sat there, and I was very nervous about this. And the gentleman who was in charge of it was a guy by the name of Hank Cashton. And Hank was a very forward-thinking, very brilliant individual who had that "is that so" gene ingrained. And I didn't know this at the time. And I'm sitting there really nervous as the chief investigator to deliver my report. And Hank comes in a few minutes late. He takes his coat off with a flourish. He hangs it up on the hanger behind it. He sits down at the end of the table with a couple of copies of the report. He picks one up. He ruffles through the pages. And then he throws it on the table. And I think, oh, I'm done. This is it. He's going to throw the report back at me. It's over. And instead, he looked at me and he said, I read this last night for the fourth time. And what I can say is I want more of this. So part of it is just doing it. Part of it is just getting out there and doing the thing, whatever the thing is, your review of incidents, your review of accidents, doing it differently and bringing the information to leadership in a way that allows leadership to lead. And what is leading? I mean, leading has to be redefined as well. Leading is creating a workplace where workers can be successful. This is another thing that we learned. And so in this process, leadership has to be willing to learn as well. And that's really what Dialogos did for us. They wrote a diagnostic memo that essentially said that to leadership. Leadership was kind of put on notice. The chief backed us up, and this designated safety and health official, Hank Cashton, backed us up and asked for more. So that's how the transformation took place inside the Forest Service. The next phase was to expand that learning for leadership and to put them in positions where they could question openly. Well, you know, most organizations don't do that with leadership. They don't allow leaders to question. Leaders are supposed to know. Well, that's a really dangerous place for people to be. And so what we did was we started a leadership learning journey, a safety learning journey. And we took our leaders to a whole bunch of different places. We took them to the Coast Guard. Todd Conklin was teaching at Los Alamos National Lab at the time. We took them to LANL and introduced them to these different ways of doing things and put them in a position where they could ask questions because they weren't in their own environment any longer. And that helped them because that showed them that by being in a mode of inquiry, they could actually move their learning forward, and that would help the entire agency. And then along came Edgar Schein. We brought Edgar Schein before them, and Edgar talked to them about humble inquiry. And it gelled together. So basically what we did was we built a nuanced systemic approach to how we could bring leadership along, understanding that leadership was influenced by things as well, and put them in a position where they could begin to question, is that so? And it really worked.
So I guess my question to you becomes this. So let's say, for instance, we have an organization that's listening to this podcast and they want to start that particular journey. How would the approach start? Because you have to keep in mind that a lot of organization nowadays, the way that it works is, well, if you don't have that many incidents, your management is going to have a bonus based on that. If you don't have that many fatalities, I know it's sad to say, but it's the reality of the situation. You will get some sort of bonus out of it. The other portion is we expect an operational person to be able to understand, and I'm talking about like a vice president, president, so on, to understand better in regards of a process than what an actual worker can do in regards of being safe. So how can you take that approach going into an organization and saying, these are the steps of what you should do? And I know that, you know, the U.S. Forest Service did something entirely different because they had the open mind of moving forward with it. But what would you say for a typical organization that's starting off or somebody who's trying to bring this to, let's say, for instance, the upper management, a board, and saying, these are some new ideas that we need to address?
Let me think about this a little bit now. I've got some experience in doing this with a couple of companies.
No pressure, right? No whatsoever.
Yeah, right. And I have run into this kind of resistance, right? Quite frequently, we're brought in at a level of the health and safety leadership of the organization, not necessarily at the vice president or presidential level of an organization. So often we're brought in a place where it is difficult for somebody to say, hey, leader, you need to learn, right? What we do in this particular case is we literally set the stage for a dialogue to take place between the health and safety folks and the leadership, and we usually do that around a fatality accident. Sadly, this is usually where we get the greatest amount of leverage. And in this case, what we do is we literally bring them a process now that is fully developed. Remember, the Forest Service, it wasn't fully developed in the beginning. But now we bring them a fully developed process that they can use to create something that is meaningful and is a learning product for them. And then point to other successful places where this has taken place, not just within the Forest Service, but other places where it's taken place. And we show them that the possibility exists for them to do this and whatever it was that they were doing before. So we don't undermine their old systems of doing things. That was a mistake I think we made early on. And I think some of the folks that bring safety differently and other concepts like this forward, not all of them, I think a lot of them are really good about this, but some of them set up this either or. You've got to do this or you've got to do this. You can't do both. And what we realized is you can't do both. You can still do a technical report. In fact, there's a very important place for technical reports within the learning review. And sometimes the technical report takes precedence over the social aspect of the accident. But other times the social aspect takes precedence over the technical. And we let leadership know this in the first dialogue, where we first present them with, if they want to continue to use the language of investigation, then we don't undermine that. But we bring it to them in their board or their review process, and we show them that there is another way to do it. And then we gauge, based on their response, how much further we can push. The other thing that happens inside organizations, which I think is really interesting, is something that Todd brought out of Los Alamos National Laboratory to the public, and this is this idea of HOP and these HOPE dialogues or HOP dialogues. And these are things that are designed, and where we had the most success with them in my experience is where we have leadership and the field folks in the same room. And we have these dialogues that generally challenge people's thinking around causality, but don't do it around something that is unique to that company. Do it around something that is completely outside what the company's experience is, because that allows people to move into that mode of inquiry. And so between the HOPE dialogues and or HOP dialogues and the actual investigative process differently and presenting different information differently to leadership, we begin to network a change in the way leadership approaches these problems. And that becomes something that permeates the entire agency over time. Remember, this is a cultural shift. It's not going to happen overnight. And we're fighting a cultural shift that exists in the media. I mean, if there's an accident, the first thing they want to know is causality, right? Yesterday, on CBS News, Tony DeCoppola is interviewing the head of the school system for Los Angeles, and he asks the question, well, you've got the teachers here on the one side, you've got the school system on the other side, who's the villain? And the answer on the part of the administrator is, does there have to be a villain? I don't think there has to be a villain. And that was really an insightful answer, but the media push is, we need to have that villain. And Tony DeCoppola comes back essentially saying, well, yes, there has to be, because this side is against that side. That's not really true, right? Neither one of them has to be a villain. Each one of them has a perspective that has to be enjoyed in order for us to find a solution. And it's, if we stay in this language of good, bad, villain, we're never going to move forward. And here we're talking on this podcast on the anniversary of Billy Sullenberg landing on the Hudson. And why wouldn't we talk about that for a moment? Because had everybody died on that airplane, we would not be calling him a hero. We'd have a very different word for him, and it's probably the same one that Tony DeCoppola used. So when we start to think about the way we make these judgments, often they're around the outcome. And the one thing that the worker doesn't know in this process, especially if there's going to be a fatal accident, is what that outcome is. And so to try and hold them to a standard of prediction is completely unfair. And after a while, leadership begins to understand that. It takes a lot of dialogues. It takes a lot of exposure. It takes some really dedicated internal folks inside the agencies. This is one of the other things that I think is really important. We can't do this completely from an outside, like a contractor can't come in and suddenly imbue leadership with this information. There has to be somebody on the inside, an internal champion or set of champions. And there has to be an ability to hold these dialogues, to allow people to begin to talk about these tough subjects and begin to challenge the way they've thought about things over time. And it does work.
So you know that automatically when you go into an organization, there's a couple of questions that come up right away. Number one being, how long is this going to take to be developed? Opposed to, you know, thinking about it's a culture shift. They want to know how long it's going to take. The other question that normally comes up is, what is my return on investment? And then I know you started speaking about HOP, but I want to make sure that I ask this question because I always like to ask it. Do you start referencing about HOP and let people know that it's a philosophy and not a program? Because those things normally surprise most organizations. And I know I kind of tied three questions into one there, but I would love for you to actually address those.
Yeah. So let's start with the, let's just kind of think about it holistically and see if we can answer all three questions. Okay. So answering a question about HOP depends on where the organization is in terms of their sense of linearity. If they're still stuck deeply in a cause and effect relationship, it can be really, really challenging to come at them and say, hey, this is a philosophy. This is, you're going to look at this and start to think about things from a perspective that is not only systemic, but it's also fundamentally based in principles and a shift in principles. You know, you could just look at a whole bunch of engineers and see their eyes just glaze over. And I know this is to be true because I'm actually a professor in an engineering program, and I've tried it and seen it. Engineers don't relate to this well. So how do you bring engineers over into a different place? It's a very different type of conversation. So that's part of it. It is important for them to understand that it's not a HOP is not a process. It's a journey. But sometimes it's not easy for organizations to understand that because, again, you're saying that we need a return on investment. Let's look at strange circumstances like trying to bring this to the federal government, where we have people who are in power for up to 4 years, maybe longer, maybe not longer, but they're thinking in terms of four-year brackets of time. Cultural shifts in a four-year bracket of time are really difficult to institute. So how do you make that happen? The fallback position here is to help the organizations understand that shifting language shifts culture. And this is where the work of my wife comes in so importantly, is that this idea that if you can shift the language within the organization, you can begin to shift the culture without even trying. Now, how hard is it to shift language? Well, you start writing in a certain way. You start removing causality from your language. You start removing these direct relationship types of things from anything other than engineering problem solution. Remember, you can't completely cut it out because it does exist and it is important in certain areas. For example, ergonomics, that's still a really important place for cause and effect relationships to occur. But in the interpretation of something that's beautifully ergonomically designed, in that interpretation, we may have some problems. So it becomes an effort to expand and say yes and in the place of these discussions with leadership. Now I don't know if I was able to answer all three of those questions. I tried. Did I do it?
I think you did a pretty good tie-in if you asked me, but you do reference something on there that I want to go back to, and I know that you talk about your wife or speak about your wife in regards of language and how important it is. Now, I will tell you, the people that sit on the other side of the house, and when I say that, I mean the people that like to talk about behavior-based safety, and I know we can sit around and talk about behavior-based safety versus HOP and all that kind of fun stuff. I always look at it as a Republican talking about Democrats and vice versa, or Chevy versus Ford, and I always kind of find it kind of interesting on how some people will turn entirely when you mention one over the other. But if you listen to a lot of people that speak about behavior-based safety, they reference that also that there needs to be a language change. And I know that philosophies, you'll never be able to mix those two together in regards of HOP and behavior-based safety. But do you just think that overall as an industry, our language is incorrect on how we approach things overall?
So I really don't like to make a judgment on whether it's incorrect or correct. I think instead, and this is what I've really advocated for in every discussion that I've made with any company, with any degree or level of leadership, even with the federal government. I went to the White House when Obama was president and did a presentation there on firefighter safety. And essentially what I said is this: you can look at a behavioral-based safety model, you can look at the HOP model, and the thing that you need to ask yourself at the end of the day is, after you've done the presentations and you've done the discussions around both of these two things, you need to ask yourself one thing, and that is, am I moving learning forward in the organization? Am I putting our people in a position where they're going to provide me with more information? Because again, as I say, information is the currency of safety. If it's doing those two things, you're going to be moving in a positive direction. So I'm not going to undermine behavioral-based safety. I don't personally advocate for it because I see some problems with it in terms of its ability to move learning forward in an organization. And that makes me question it, and that makes me look at how they present in terms of language. And very frequently in behavioral-based safety models, you see things like, well, we'll make a determination of people's activities, and if they're found to be reckless, then we're going to take punitive action. Well, reckless is a judgment in that case. And I have to ask, if we're making a judgment of action, is that putting people in a position where they're going to willingly give us more information? Is that putting us in a position where we're maximizing the learning from the processes that we're endeavoring to pursue? And I'm going to sum this up with something that the chief of the Forest Service said when we instituted the learning review. And he says, accountability is important. It's important before, during, and after any type of an event. But after an accident, a fatality accident in particular, we are accountable as an organization to learn everything we can from that incident. That's a very different perspective. And so I think that when we start to see leadership embrace that idea, it doesn't matter what label we put on the safety activity. What matters is how we deliver that safety activity to the worker, and how we invest in leadership, and how we invest in corporate and organizational learning. And remember, it's not learning what to do and what not to do. That comes in the form of teaching. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the capacity of the workforce to make sense of conflicting information, learn in the moment, and innovate solutions. That's the skill set we want to start to invest in. And that's one of the reasons that aviation is so safe, is because we're able to do that in aviation.
Ivan, I have to tell you, that probably might have summed up the best answer I've ever received related to that question. And I'm not saying that because you're here talking to me. But I'm telling you that based on all the interviews that I've done so far to this point.
Well, thanks for that.
Ivan, if people want to know more information about you, where can they find out some more?
So my wife and I have a company called Dynamic Inquiry, and we do not have a website. We haven't needed one. We're staying as busy as we probably need to be. But if they do want more information and they want some help and they want to see where we went wrong in the Forest Service and what we've learned along the way, I can be reached at dynamicinquiry@me.com.
Well, Ivan, I appreciate you coming on to Safety FM.
Well, thank you. I really look forward to keeping a dialogue with you, Jay, and I look forward to our next talk.
This episode has been powered by Safety FM.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and its guest and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the company. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are only examples. They should not be utilized in the real world as the only solution available, as they are based only on very limited and dated open source information. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the company. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, recording, or otherwise, without prior written permission of the creator of the podcast, Jay Allen.
SafetyFM.com.
So do you feel like you're missing out on what everyone is starting to do now, that live streaming thing, and you don't know where to start or what to do? I have the resource and the information to provide to you in regards on how you can stream onto 40 social media platforms all at one time. Yes, that's 440 social media platforms all at one time. All you'll need to do is go to safetyfm.com /1. That's safetyfm.com/1. That's O-N-E. So just in case, and you'll be able to start live streaming just like you're hearing people starting to do right now, up to 40 social media platforms.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.